Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. As always, I'm your host, Anna Pajewski, and this episode I talked to artist Helen Karnak about enamel. I first met Helen when we were both working at the Institute of Making, and I found that every time I chatted to her over lunch, I learned about more and more of the awesome projects that she's been working on throughout her career. And she always had an amazing nugget of material knowledge that I didn't know about before. So I was really excited to sit down with Helen and record this conversation during the coronavirus lockdown. I started by asking Helen how she first got interested in enamel.
Well, actually, my interest started when I was at school, because I unusually had an art teacher who was a jeweller. And so I have an O level in jewellery, which is probably very rare. I don't know how many people have jewellery O levels, but I sometimes come across people with the same qualification. And it kind of ages me too, my O level. And I think that sort of set me off in being interested in various materials. And I went and did an art foundation and then decided to go on to study metal jewellery, silversmithing, and something called related arts, which was everything else, everything else material.
Okay.
And I went to quite a traditional department in a university where they had about 800 students at different levels studying various jewellery and silversmithing things.
Wow.
And I did a BA that was about testing things out, trying things out, learning very traditional techniques, but then taking them apart, which really suited me. So it was really about a lot of setting things on fire, letting things go wrong a lot. I was really lucky, I think, because a lot of places, I think, at the time were more about this is how you do something, and I didn't want to do that. So I found the right place for me and experimented a lot with trying out different materials and processes, and was taught by some really amazing crafts men and women. So I learned a lot of techniques. We would often, you know, try and we'd learn a technique over a week, and then we'd sort of take that apart over the next few weeks.
Oh, that sounds fun.
And that was a four-year course in which I also studied in Germany. And I also, it was a sandwich course, which meant that I worked for people. So I worked for an amazing, mad silversmith called Jocelyn Burton, and for the furniture designer Tom Dixon, where I did a lot of welding, And during this period, it's when I kind of first came across enamel, that I was taught enameling, which most kind of metalworking students will be taught that as a process.
Which brings us nicely onto our material for the podcast.
Yeah.
Did you want to say anything else about the career stuff before we...
Well, I mean, that was 26 years ago that I finished studying, and I went straight on to setting up a studio in London, and I've been working as an artist, working with different materials and processes, and also teaching all along the way here and abroad. So I've been a professor in Berlin, I've worked in the USA, Russia and Norway.
Maybe we can take a little step back and define what this material of enamel is and how you go about using it.
Well, at its most basic, it is ground glass, which is coloured with minerals and metal oxides. It comes in a powder form, which you'll predominantly see being used in jewellery, I guess, or in small-scale metalwork. And it's used mostly in traditionally on gold and silver. And I had trained to use it as a student, but then about 8 years after I left college, I assisted an artist in a workshop when I was teaching somewhere, and she used an industrial type process enamel. And as a lot of my work is about drawing, and I had always been striving to find a material that I could use with metal to draw, this was a kind of a moment of I found the right material. So as soon as I used this industrial material, which is basically very finely ground glass mixed with either porcelain or electrolytes, and it's used in industry, in signage, so all our London Underground signs are made of it. Your bath might be made of it, pots and pans, and some scientific equipment too. And so it's a process, I think, that could be enjoyed by all kinds of people, because you can use it in a very technical and challenging way, or in a very kind of at the opposite end, it can be used in a very experimental and quite abstract way, I think.
So you mentioned ground glass there and also metal working. How do those two relate with the process of enamelling?
Basically, you're fusing the ground glass to the metal. And so the two surfaces fuse together, and I work predominantly with steel, with industrial enamel, and you have to find a way to adhere the two surfaces. So you open up the molecules of the metal in order to allow that to happen.
How do you do that?
It's a very basic thing that I do, is I sandblast the surface.
Okay.
So you're opening up the surface of the metal, which you don't have to do with other metals. It's a bonding thing that the two materials need to fuse. So it's not just sitting on top, it's actually fusing into the surface of the metal.
Okay. So it sounds like the process involves quite a few transformations from sort of ground glass into this like fused surface that is like irreversibly bonded to metal. So how could you take us through the process of applying enamel to a piece of steel, for example?
Yeah. So the whole process of making the enamel in the first place is done in industry now. So I buy my enamels, and they're often made for large scale industrial projects, and I get part of, you know, the the material that's left over, basically, when I order it. And that comes to me in, I buy a liquid form of the enamel, and I apply, I as I just said, sandblast the surface of the steel, and then I have to, one of the most important things is mixing the material. It needs to be very well mixed. And then I apply the material by dipping the steel into the liquid enamel. And this it was a sort of innovation in the material, from only being used on flat surfaces to being able to, you know, enamel, say, kitchenware jugs and all sorts of 3D forms, which happened in about the 1900. And so when I, once I've dipped it, you leave it to dry to a sort of plaster, plaster surface. And once it's dry, you can, in my case, draw into the surface using something very sharp. So my favorite drawing tool is a scalpel. And this is a sort of sgraffito drawing process. So drawing into the material.
Okay.
And after I draw into it, I then fire it in a kiln, an enamel kiln, and it's fired at around 820 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
And then after that, you have to, there's a lot of waiting in between these processes, because a lot of the process is about being very patient, and I find if I rush anything or want to speed it up, it will always go wrong. So one of the most important processes to me is after the enamel comes out of the kiln, I do a lot of grinding of surfaces, because actually what I'm really interested in is the metal below. So whilst industrial enamel is seen as a really good material in industry to stop corrosion, so you coat a surface and, you know, you won't get rust, you won't get corrosion, I like to do the opposite. So I'm looking for corrosion.
Okay.
I'm looking to disrupt the surface and to find the surface below the enamel. And so I do a lot of grinding of surfaces. And I guess that's, it's quite a painterly thing as well. I see it as quite an important process of working on the surface. And you obviously, when the enamel comes out of the kiln, it's glossy. It's a glass, glossy surface. And I'm really interested in matte surfaces. So grinding down from the gloss to a matte.
Ah, interesting.
Peeling some of the things below. So you often, there's a kind of something that goes on in the kiln that's really interesting. So there are a lot of things that are very much known about what's going to happen in a process, and then there's the absolute unknown. So even if you've planned everything, you may find you open the kiln and something else has happened.
That's definitely my experience with dabbling in ceramics. Never comes out like you think it will.
No. And this can be very frustrating, but it can also be something very enlightening and quite incredible. And sometimes incredible things happen. And I found that the grinding process is very much a revealing process, because you can reveal some of the things that happened in the kiln.
Ah, interesting.
They're sometimes quite inexplicable, but I've done a lot of teaching of enamel, I always describe it a little bit like cooking, that you have a recipe and you have a method and you sort of follow it, and then go off course, make up your own kind of ideas about what you're doing, but also need to make a note of what you've done, because there can be something very small that happens that if you don't record it or you don't notice it, you won't know how to do it again.
Oh, that's very scientific. That's exactly what you have to do in the lab as well. Because, you know, repeating experiments is such a huge part of the scientific method. You know, it's not really even considered a proper experiment if you can't repeat it and show you get the same result again.
Well, this is just the same. I mean, I have to repeat, repeat, repeat. And I've always said to people that I've worked with, if you get something you like, just repeat it immediately, because you're not going to know. If you leave it 10 minutes, you won't necessarily do exactly the same thing again. So, it's very much repeating.
Mm. Is it easy to achieve the same results again?
I think it's actually it can be really difficult or really easy.
Mm.
I mean, I've done some things that I've never been able to do again, even though I've tried. It's not random, but it can be the combination of different materials. It can be a second of time. It could be the temperature of the room. You get used to a kiln. So if you're using a different kiln, you then have to find out how to use that and, you know, what temperature it's really working at. And I think I do use pyrometers, so temperature gauges, but I tend to just use my own sense of timing now.
Interesting.
Something will be ready.
Yeah. It strikes me, though, that you can measure the temperature all you like and measure the number of milliseconds that it's been in there. But you mentioned a process earlier that might be slightly more difficult to control, which is the rusting of the metal.
Yes.
And it's not exactly an organic process, but it's definitely mediated by the environment. And I would expect, or you can prove, you can say that I'm wrong, that trying to control and repeat that rusting process would be very difficult.
It's really difficult, but I think that's why I really love it, because it is unpredictable and you'll get something different. And I will have to sometimes just do it over and over again to get the right thing. So depending on where you are, I mean, the studio I have at the moment is right by the Thames at Woolwich, and I get really great rust there.
Okay.
And I don't do anything at all complex. I put stuff in water and leave it for different amounts of time, and then leave parts of it out in the air and leave things to dry. But I can get some great results in that space.
And is that noticeably different from other places you've worked in?
Yeah. It's really quite different.
Amazing.
But then also it very much depends on the metal. So when I buy metal, sometimes it just doesn't rust well. And I think sometimes, not often, but sometimes I use low carbon steel for enameling. But the higher carbon steel rusts better. And then just different batches of the material seem to rust better too. And the interesting thing is that then when the work goes out to different places, it changes while it's out. So if it comes back to me, it can come back looking quite different.
That's amazing. So it's still sort of living and changing throughout its life.
Yeah, and it's what I'm really interested in. And it very much relates to something that I've been trying to do more recently with my work as well. I find that part of the material really fascinating.
So let's talk about some of your recent projects then.
I was going to talk about a project that I've done with my long-term work and life partner who I share my workshop with, David Gates, who's a furniture designer. And over the years we've made work together, but you know, it's funny that even if you share a space with somebody, you don't often find the time to work with them unless you make the space to do that. And we were working with a gallery, and the gallerist, Sarah, asked us if we'd like to make some work together, which was a perfect way to start to do what we kept promising to do, which was about 4 years ago. So David makes furniture, mostly from wood with some metal. And the previous work that we've made, that we've got quite a lot of around the house, was using the enamel as a sort of decorative surface, so embedding enamel panels into the surface of a piece of furniture. So I've got a nice medicine cabinet that's got a red cross on it, so that's kind of all nicely embedded in the surface. But we wanted to try and use the enamel as a constructional part of the work. So it's quite one of the things that you have to think about with enamel and objects is that you have to try and do everything constructional before you enamel or leave holes and things to rivet or join things together. So you have to think about joining, because you can't just it's not easy to join things after the work's been enamelled.
Ah, right. So you have to do things in a slightly different order or plan ahead.
Yeah, you have to plan ahead. You have to think about how you're going to put something together. And also, it's interesting that the enamel, if you enamel on a curve, there's a lot of strength in that place. It's something that doesn't really kind of, if you think about it, it doesn't really make sense. So people can never understand how I make enamel vessels as well, bowls. And whenever I'm showing somebody how to enamel, they can't understand how the enamel can stay on the curve when you put it in the kiln. They think it's going to fall off.
Right. Sort of flow around like molten glass.
Yeah. And it's the same with a sort of corner in enamel, that actually it can be a point of strength in the piece. So we made some quite sculptural furniture works that are half metal, half wood, metal, enameled metal. So they're constructed and they hold each other up. So the enamel pieces hold up the wooden pieces. So instead of David maybe making a joint, a dovetail joint at a corner, we were joining the wood to the enamel panels.
Oh, interesting.
Did that present?
Sorry, go on.
I wish I could show you a piece now. It's quite interesting now talking about it and trying to make it make sense without seeing the object.
Yeah, well, maybe we can share some photos of it on the podcast social media so people can have a little look.
See what I'm trying to talk about.
Did joining the enamelled metal and the wood present any sort of material problems?
I suppose the main thing, as you just said, was that we would have to plan ahead and then troubleshoot. And I guess we've made quite a lot of pieces together now, and each iteration of a piece, you work something else out from the previous one. We both really enjoy the oxidization that takes place between certain woods and metal as well. So the oxidization that takes place between oak and steel, for example, and so we'll promote some of that and make you know, inky points where the two pieces join. So it's a really lovely amalgamation of materials, and a bit like the process of promoting the oxidization and rusting of the enamel steel. In this, it's about promoting this oxidization of the oak or other materials when they're put together as well. So quite a lot of cold joining. We never use glue. It's It's quite a funny kind of thing as a sort of student of working with a material. You're always told to veer away from glue and find a different way. So
the purists' approach.
lots of putting things together through tabs. I'm just trying to think what we did. Maybe some joining a little bit, like some wooden joinery, but with metal and wood.
Yeah,
instead.
That was one question that sprung to mind, actually. Did you have to treat the metal like wood or treat the wood like metal or find new ways to join the two?
That's a really interesting question. I think... Yeah, they're such different materials in a way, but we did quite a lot of slotting and then drilling and pegging and sort of putting the two materials together. So slotting the metal into the wood and then drilling and pegging through those areas. And you get some really nice amalgamations of materials. And it's something I really want to do more of and wanted to... kind of we'd like to make bigger work, because actually you could, but at the moment I'm working from home, so I'm working smaller at the moment. So that's something for the future, I think.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah. So that brings me nicely on to my next line of inquiry, which is enamelling through time. So you just mentioned that your enamelling processes have changed in the current time because you're having to work much smaller. I think, like, speaking more broadly about enamelling as a material and a process, you mentioned before that when we were able to sandblast, that opened up new materials for enamelling at the beginning of the 20th century. How long have we been enamelling for, and what's the sort of historical story of it?
We've been enamelling for since the 13th century.
Okay.
It's quite incredible, really. I often work with people that just are amazed that it's still the same material. We've been enamelling across the centuries, and we've innovated, I think, and we still are innovating. I get quite sort of gobsmacked about the fact that it's a material that has been used by so many people over so many centuries, and yet we're still innovating and using it in different ways. But you can, in jewellery, for example, I guess you still recognise those early kind of enamelling pieces. That some of the earliest pieces were rings that were made in Cyprus or found. And the fact that, you know, clearly people enamel in the same way today, really, that enamel was first used in that time.
I suppose in that time that was when glassworking was really getting going. I think the Venetian glassblowers, their heyday was sort of like the 14th, 15th centuries. Mm-hmm. So I guess in the 13th century, perhaps people were starting to experiment with glass. But do you think it would have been the metal workers that would have picked up the enamelling rather than glassblowers?
Yes, probably. But although I'm biased.
Sure, yeah, I suppose.
I think probably. Yeah, I think so. Although enamelling takes place on glass as well, and I'm not sure about the when, you know, the first enamelling on glass took place.
Interesting.
As well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think probably in metal because... in jewellery and small-scale objects, people were trying to add decoration and colour from an early stage that, yeah, it was probably within metal that it was first seen.
Interesting. And I guess we spoke about rusting earlier. One of the places that people be familiar with enamel perhaps is enamel bathtubs. And yes. I guess in that setting, the enamel is there to protect the metal from rusting.
Yeah.
So maybe... before we really knew about, you know, percentages of carbon in steel and how to make stainless steel, which came much, much later, was enamelling maybe used as well as a sort of metal protection material?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in food and cookware, it's been used for quite a long time, and that's definitely for protection and more now as well in innovation. You'll see it being used in industry, you see it in tunnels, in cladding, say on the underground. I think there are quite a lot of enamel panels, not just the signage, but you know, some of the tunnels that are say white, that will be enamel.
Oh wow. One
of the major innovations really was out of necessity on the London Underground. The signage was, I think, early days of the Underground, the signage was enamel. And if you see an old enamel sign, which you don't see too many of these days, but you might see chips in the enamel. If you see a sign on the Underground that's chipped, it's more than likely to be an earlier piece of signage. Because the innovation is that it's a lot thinner now and they can screen print this very thin enamel coating.
Oh, wow.
But the enamel signage on the Underground went plastic for some time until the King's Cross disaster in 1987 when many people were killed from fumes.
From burning plastic?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so that's when the signage went back to enamel.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, obviously very tragic as well.
It's really tragic, but a massive sort of innovation in all our signage. So you'll often find me outside tapping on things, checking whether the signage is enamel or plastic, but you find a lot more enamel signage because it's so resilient. And I think it actually is surprising because enamel and large-scale enamelling was used quite a lot by artists in the sort of 50s and 60s. There are some huge enamel works that you can find. I was working in Berlin for some time and I noticed there were quite a few murals and communist murals there that were enamel, vitreous enamel. But you don't see that as much now, although that sometimes London Transport commission artists here to make enamel cladding. And there are some interesting examples of that around London.
Oh, so it's interesting, the return to the old technology, as it were, sort of away from plastic.
Yeah, yeah, it is interesting. And I feel like that opened up the arena again for public art and for different people to use it somehow. But I think there's a real gap, actually, because before I spoke to you, I was having a look at how it's being used in industry at the moment, and I could see that it would be great for an artist to go and work in big industry. And I think that there used to be a lot more projects that artists did in industry.
All right.
And yeah.
Maybe that could be your next project.
Yeah. I did. I'd started to work at the Institute of Making on working with different surfaces in enamel. And I'd actually got a small bursary to go and work in an enamel factory to try and work larger, but that's obviously on hold at the moment. But
that sounds cool.
I'd be able to do that as well. So
what's next for you then? What have you got coming up?
Well, the next thing I was going to be doing with the enamel was going to work in a factory, and that's been put on hold, as I said. I've actually ended up because I haven't really been able to use my studio properly since lockdown, so I ended up actually going the opposite way. My intention was to work larger scale, and I've bought a new mini kiln.
Oh, cool.
Small scale, so I've gone a bit smaller at the moment, so I'm just trying to continue with experiments with different surfaces. I mean, I think it's a lifelong project. I don't think there's so much to be done with this. And actually, I always work with steel at the moment, and I decided over lockdown to return to copper. So that's what has come next, just through being locked down. But I usually work with a very minimal palette. But I decided I wanted to experiment a bit more with colour. But I really enjoy the sort of natural colours. So I've been working with fluxes, and I suppose then again you're working with the colours that you get through the firing of the metal with the enamel. So you're seeing the colour of the metal through the glass.
It surprises me, given how sort of extensive your experience is, it surprises me that there's still experiments for you to do with it.
Oh God, I feel like it's never ending. I think you could work on it forever, and you know, in just one way as well.
Yes.
In a very minimal way, you could just keep going in a very minimal way.
Yeah. So if people have been interested to hear about enamel the material and enamelling the process, where can people find out more about it? I suppose one thing people can do is just to go outside and tap signs.
You're travelling, yeah, if you've got an enamel bath or any whiteware, you can have a look at it. And it's always interesting to see if you can spot where it's been how it's been fired, because the glass melts, you have to hold it on something so it doesn't get stuck to the surface. So there will always be some black points somewhere where it's been held on spikes.
Oh, that's a fun piece of homework.
Yeah.
A fun piece of, I suppose, material forensic science.
Yeah, I mean, I went to college at Aldgate East, and they used to have the most fantastic London Underground signs there that were very old, and you could explore the sort of edges, and you could see how thick the enamel was on that. And the London Transport have a museum where they keep the underground signs, but I don't think it's open to the public.
Oh, that's a shame.
And the signs are made by a company on the Isle of Wight called AJ Wells. And I've been there a couple of times, and they are very, they're not allowed to share the colours at the underground.
Oh, really?
No. And also, if they have a kind of misfiring, they're not allowed to give those signs away either, which is a bit of a shame.
Oh, so, that's a big shame, yeah.
Yes. But it's very interesting. And they do have an artist room there, and you can go and work there too.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, thanks so much for chatting to me, Helen. It's been really nice to catch up and brilliant to talk to you about your work, because we've worked together for, I suppose, a few months leading up to lockdown, but never had the chance to sit down and speak at length about all the stuff that you do. So, yeah, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So that was the brilliant Helen Karnak. Thanks so much to her for coming on the show. If you want to take a look at Helen's stuff and the artworks that we've been talking about in this episode, then check out her website, which is helenkarnak.co.uk. That's all for this episode. This was episode number 50 of the podcast. If you're still here, thanks for continuing to be here and supporting the podcast. If you're new, then do go back and listen to past episodes. There's many a material treasure to be found in the back catalogue. If you're enjoying the podcast, then do rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That would be awesome. And thanks to those who have supported the podcast by giving a one-time donation. Really does help to keep the podcast going, paying for the various things that I have to pay for. If you're enjoying it and have the means to support, then that would be awesome. It's at supporter.acast.com/handmade. Say hi to us online. We're on Twitter at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk, and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. Thanks as always to Dave Shepherd for our marvellous cover art and to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. A special thank you this episode to Steve Thompson, who was an epic legend and helped sort out the audio production on this particular episode. So thanks, Steve. That's all for this week. Join me again next week, where I'll be talking to Lucy Rogers about making and her first material love, wood. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time on Handmade.
Hello, Handmade listeners. I'm Barry Maxtay.
I'm Ben Vanderveld.
And we'd love you to listen to Worst Foot Forward, our podcast all about failure.
Each week we are joined by a guest to discuss the world's worst something, from detective to invasion, train to horror movie. We dive into humankind's darkest depths in search of the absolute pits.
We've even had your very own Dr. Anna Porshaisky on the show twice. In The World's Worst Material, she shared her innate hatred of graphene, and during our live show, she let loose on sea salt and is now persona non grata in the town of Malden.
On Worst Foot Forward, we've learned that conspiracy theorists think rocks aren't really hard, why one French physicist invaded the Channel Island of Sark, and how exactly to make a wasp gun.
While also uncovering the railway station of the dead, the doctor who put goat balls into human scrotums, and the West End musical funded by bird poo.
Subscribe to Worst Foot Forward on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Check out our website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com, and join us for some fun-filled zero worship.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.